You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Music has served as a form of political and social expression in the U.S. going back to the Revolutionary War and beyond. When we think of protest music, we might jump to the Vietnam War era of the 1960s and 70s, like Fortunate Son by Creedence Clearwater Revival. But artists throughout the 20th century and on to today continue to write songs that offer commentary on pressing issues. What's changed over the years? Is the golden age of the protest song over, or have things just changed? You can join in at 800-642-1234. When I say protest music, what does that mean to you? What do you think of? What era do you think of? What performer or song? Is there a song or artist from a particular time that stays with you? Do you notice when music has a political or social message behind it? Do you want music to have political or social messages behind it, or do you want music to get away from those things? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alexander Shashko is a lecturer in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison who teaches about music and culture. He's also a voter for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Alexander, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. It's nice to be back.
Well, I imagine protest music has been around since there was music, but when did it really get mainstream popularity in the U.S.? When, you know, it wasn't just the people, you know, singing it, but it became part of pop culture?
Well, that's a great question. Of course, there has been, as you noted, music about protest and music about politics as long as we have had music. If you think about it, songs about war are certainly songs that are political, and those are among the oldest songs we have in human culture. So the idea of having political music has always existed, and it has always existed in the United States. In every single era, we have songs that are about the political conditions that we are in, songs of protest as well. In the modern recorded era, you can find songs about the Depression. You can find songs about World War II. There's really no era in which there isn't music about politics and protest, whether it's about the economy and poverty, whether it's about war, whether it's about the changes in society, whether it's about race relations or gender. They have always been there. But in the modern era that really starts with the birth of rhythm and blues and rock and roll, it is the 60s, the mid-60s into the early 70s, that is the first period that we really look at a moment when there is a kind of merging of protest music and popular music, popular hits that are consistently songs about what is going on in American society in explicit ways. So that's really the moment when it starts in that particular era. And it is also, you know, in part a way in which we periodize that, because that is the moment that many of us first remember that popular political music emerging.
Is there a significant difference between, you know, a song with political lyrics and songs that people might sing at a protest? You know, is there something different with the communal experience of singing "We Shall Overcome" at a civil rights rally, or "This Land Is Our Land" or whatever, versus, you know, a song that you kind of passively listen to?
Well, obviously, it can be a different experience. If you are listening to the song by yourself in isolation, or if you're driving in your car, it may have you thinking about politics. It may have you contemplating political action in some form or another, but you're by yourself. And so the relationship is between your own thoughts and the art itself. That is part of the call and response, the longstanding tradition in which music helps to form community and creates a kind of dialogue between the art and individuals. But that becomes much more straightforward and explicit when it happens in a communal setting. So if people are singing the music together at a march, at a protest, in a performance, then there is a kind of shared sense of identity and a shared sense of purpose that comes out of singing that song and relating it to the situation that you are in.
Let's dive into songs related to civil rights now. You sent us some suggestions for influential or important protest-related songs. "People Get Ready" by Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions from 1965, kind of a movement anthem. Here's a listen.
People get ready, there's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board.
Thank those of us listening with headphones getting a stereo there back and forth. Alexander, why did songs like that one, People Get Ready, resonate well with people in the fight for civil rights?
So the fight for civil rights was a longstanding one for African Americans. Of course, as long as African Americans have been on this continent, they have struggled to gain civil rights and to have equal opportunity to be both citizens and to be politically active in American society. So it has always been part of the African American struggle. And that struggle has been at times very deeply tied to the church. The church was a location where people could gather, where African Americans could gather, where they could talk about the struggles that they were experiencing, where they could escape from those struggles and find refuge and community and joy. And so the sounds of gospel music have long been a sound that African Americans have used as a way to express their view of the world, including through politics. Now, that has often been metaphorical through gospel music, and it's one of the reasons why African Americans could get away with singing those songs, because they were metaphorical as opposed to being explicit. As we get into the era of rhythm and blues and soul, what we see are artists who are deeply grounded in the gospel tradition and in the gospel impulse, the idea of finding redemption or finding a better place both in this world and beyond, and they translate it into secular music. So as they do that, they take many of the sounds of community, of redemption, of gathering together to make progress, and they translate them from a purely religious setting into one that is more or less secular. And that's what a song like People Get Ready by Curtis Mayfield does. Curtis Mayfield, who was from Chicago, was deeply connected to church music, and then took that lesson and those experiences and brought them into the pop music that he was creating. So a song like People Get Ready is about the train to Jordan. It is not just literally about that, but it is also, even more importantly, metaphorically about the idea of finding a way for people to get to the promised land, to get to the place that they want to be, where they can find happiness, where they can find freedom. And that's really the purpose of the song.
We are talking about the history of protest music in the United States with Alexander Shashko, who teaches about music and culture at UW-Madison. You can join in with your questions, maybe your favorite songs, artists, memories of protest music at 800-642-1234. Brian joins us now in Green Bay. Brian, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Brian?
Well, I wanted to bring up a band that is alternative rock or maybe punk rock in its origin that started in, I believe, the 90s, known as Rage Against the Machine. And they were a political band that decided to do the opposite of the Gospels, actually. Instead of being metaphorical, they were very direct in their message. And singer, songwriter, and activist, lead singer, the indefatigable Zach De La Rocha, and the guitarist, Mr. Tom Morello, who is insurmountable in his talents, both have continued to create music and are continuing to be on tour given the time and age that we live in, and can continue to spread a political message that is a bit more in your face. And the band name being Rage Against the Machine seems to speak for itself, in my opinion, as to their message and their purpose as a band.
Brian, thanks for the call. Alexander.
Well, you're not going to hear me disagree with you about the importance of Rage Against the Machine. I actually did vote for them when they were a nominee for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year. They did not get in. I think it's probably a matter of time before they do. But in any event, I absolutely agree about Rage Against the Machine being a really important band in the history of both rock music and also the history of protest music. Tom Morello is an incredibly innovative guitarist, and the group really took on the mantle of protest bands that had come before them, both from the world of rock and punk in particular, but also from hip hop. And part of what makes Rage Against the Machine such a powerful group is that they're really probably the most both musically influential and politically active of all of the bands that are kind of rap rock hybrid groups, the groups that draw from both the rock tradition and the hip hop tradition. And so what you hear when you listen to Rage Against the Machine is a group that is drawing on groups from the MC5 to the Clash, on the rock side of things, but also drawing from groups like Public Enemy on the hip hop side of things. And in the process, bringing together a kind of fusion of those two worlds that is also meant to represent a way of bridging those two worlds and looking for common cause, because it's often the case, both with musical genres and with protest, that they often can't hear one another or can't work with one another because they're so devoted to the particular issues that they're dealing with. And part of what Rage Against the Machine was trying to accomplish, both symbolically through their sound and explicitly through their lyrics, was to bring those two worlds together.
Brian, thanks for the call. I'm sorry, we didn't pull any Rage Against the Machine, but in these more in-your-face style, Alexander, you just mentioned Public Enemy. Here's their 1988 Fight the Power.
Gotta give us what we want. Gotta give us what we need.
Hey.
Our freedom of speech is freedom of death.
We got to fight the powers that be. Fight the power.
Alexander, the hip-hop thread there, obviously a very different sound than the more mellow Curtis Mayfield we heard earlier.
Absolutely. A different sound. Although, certainly there was a point later when Curtis Mayfield was a lot closer to Public Enemy than he was with People Get Ready. But yeah, that is the sound of frustration and of anger. But above all, it's really a sound that is just trying to get people's attention. For many African Americans, especially younger generations of African Americans in the 1980s, they felt that their voices were not being heard in the political discourse of the day, that much of the dialogue about race relations was, in their view, a kind of tired discussion of whether or not the civil rights movement had fully succeeded, about whether or not race relations was something that had been somehow resolved in the 1960s, and that there really wasn't a lot more to talk about. And what a group like Public Enemy was trying to accomplish was to be heard through all of that static, and to be heard when there was a lot of silence about the experience that young African-Americans and young African-American men in particular were experiencing and dealing with. And so they created both lyrics that were purposefully confrontational and more importantly, in my opinion, a sound that was purposely confrontational, that they wanted the sound of sirens. They wanted the sound of the city. They wanted a chaotic kind of sound that would grab you by the lapels and force you to pay attention to them so that you couldn't turn away from the things that they wanted to say. And in that sense, they really took political hip hop to a different level. It had already existed. Grandmaster Flash's and the Furious Five's The Message, of course, was the first big political hip hop song. And there were groups like Boogie Down Production. But Public Enemy really take it to an entirely different level. They make politics the centerpiece of the music that they're creating and thus create an opening for hip hop artists to be more politically engaged through their music.
We're talking about the history and evolution of protest music in the U.S. with UW-Madison lecturer Alexander Shashko. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your favorites, your memories about protest music. 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, hear from more of you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. That's Bruce Springsteen's 1984 hit, Born in the USA, his response to the end of the Vietnam War and how veterans were treated when they returned home. We continue our talk about protest and political music, how it's changed across the decades. Alexander Shashko is with us, lecturer in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison, who teaches about music and culture. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Gail is with us in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. Oh, well, it goes back. The tried and true Buffalo Springfield, 1966, for what it's worth. Everybody's right, but everybody's wrong. And that goes with every battle, every outcry, every protest we've ever had, and we're still having with an adulterated Supreme Court going against women's reproductive rights. It's right there. And then my second is Richie Havens, Freedom. That is just a constant. He sang his heart out at Woodstock and made that song. And if it's not everybody's anthem, it should be.
Gail, thanks for the call. And that was interesting, Alexander. She talked about how the same song, in this case, For What It's Worth, can apply to a lot of different situations. Elastic protest song may fit a lot of different circumstances.
Absolutely. And that is a song that has survived through the years, that any time there has been a moment of political turmoil, especially regarding war, For What It's Worth has emerged again. It is a song that not only got played again when the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan began, but it was cover artists at that time and sampled. And in fact, Stephen Stills is actually on a Public Enemy song in which they sample For What It's Worth, a song called He Got Game. And so that tradition of taking those old songs and reimagining them in a new era has lived on to this day, has certainly lived on into the era of hip hop. And that has happened for a long time. If you think about what artists like Richie Havens were doing during the folk revival, much of what they were doing was to draw from political folk music from an earlier era, from the 1920s or 30s or 40s, and then to both, you know, play those songs again in the context of a new time and draw off of those musical traditions to create new songs to fit the times that they are in. So both of those artists and those songs that they performed really represent a link in the chain of tradition, both past and into our present day, in which those songs live on as anthems for a kind of protest that people want to engage in.
Thanks for that call, Gail. We'll go to Tom now in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. There was a song that was sung a lot during the Vietnam War era. It was written by a folk singer, Native American woman, Buffy St. Marie, and it was covered by a British folk singer, Donovan, called The Universal Soldier. It spoke about how patriots of any country fight for love of their own country.
Tom, thanks for the call. Alexander?
Yeah, that is absolutely a song that sort of creates this complex scenario in which it is engaging in both the questions of the importance of war, but also the importance of country and identity and who's responsible for fighting. Is a soldier someone who is responsible for making the choices about whether they fight or whether they are, or are they someone who is, you know, being asked to do their part for the community within which they live? You know, ultimately what it says is that everyone needs to be responsible for their own actions and everyone needs to make their own choices. And of course, in the context of the Vietnam War, that was a very, very heated subject, because between the draft and those who were choosing to fight, there were a lot of hard individual choices between a sense of duty, a sense of patriotism to country, and then a sense of patriotism to ideas, or a sense of justice and in terms of fighting war and of being someone who's willing to kill in order to win that war. And so that those kind of complicated questions are always part of any kind of protest music tradition, especially when it comes to war. There's a whole subgenre of music, and it's really not a subgenre, it's its own genre, that are songs about the experience of the soldiers themselves. And Fortunate Son, which you played earlier, is a prime example of that. That is a song that is not taking a position so strongly on the import or on the on whether or not the Vietnam War should be fought, but rather on who is fighting it and what the consequences are for both those who fight it and those who do not. So that question about individual responsibility and the choices that we make is one that we often hear when it comes to political music, and especially political music about war.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to take our last few minutes, Alexander, to look at political music today. I think it's easy to turn and say, okay, yeah, the 60s, early 70s, that was the golden age, not so much anymore. You don't buy that, though.
I do not. There is lots of political music. Now, there are a few reasons why that may not seem as apparent as it has in the past. One is that there's just so much music today that there's more of everything, including protest music. It's also the case that in the internet age and in the world of streaming that we're in, and in a world of instantaneous and mass amounts of information, a protest song doesn't quite have the same kind of time to gather an audience and to become anthemic because there's just so much popular culture that passes through us on any given day, let alone a week or in a month. And so it's a little bit harder for it to stand out than it had before, but it still does happen. If you think about just a few years ago, a song like All Right by Kendrick Lamar or Formation by Beyonce, typically at a moment when there are social movements going on, those songs then start to have a greater resonance than they would otherwise. The real key to protest music becoming memorable is if there's a movement behind it. It's a kind of symbiotic relationship. The songs are inspired by the movement. The movement is inspired by the songs. The movement might create some of the language or take some of the acts that an artist will then use to write a song. And at the same time, they might be articulating the sentiments of people in the movement that they may not have articulated otherwise for themselves, and they can now sing it in a kind of communal setting. So there is absolutely protest music today. There is lots of protest music today, but it doesn't quite exist in the same kind of cultural.
There is a woman in the vice president's mansion.
That was an interview, a re-listened interview with Alexander Shashko from UW-Madison, looking at the history of protest music in the United States. You can keep sharing your favorites, by the way. Email ideas at WPR.org if there was a protest song that is currently meaningful to you or was at some point in your life. Email us about it, ideas at WPR.org. Coming up after the news, should marijuana be legalized? According to a recent poll, the majority of Wisconsin voters say yes. We'll find out how public opinion on marijuana legalization has changed over the last few years and check out what's going on around the country. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, do humans have a monopoly on dreaming? The author of a new book looks at the mysterious world of animal dreams and what that tells us about how their minds work. Now, Marquette University Law School poll published this past Wednesday shows that 69% of Wisconsin voters support the legalization of marijuana. Historically, Republican voters have leaned against legalization, but for the first time, two Marquette polls this year find that just over half of Republican voters are in favor of legalizing cannabis. Marijuana remains illegal in the state with Republican opposition in the state legislature. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you had the option, would you vote to legalize marijuana? If so, medicinally only or also recreationally? Are you one of those Republicans who supports marijuana legalization? Has your mind, whatever your party you think of yourself as a part of, has your mind changed on this issue in recent years? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Robert Mikos is a law professor at Vanderbilt University focusing on federalism and drug law, including marijuana legalization. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, we've seen over time this gradual increase in support for marijuana legalization in Wisconsin, including among Republican voters. Now, this year, two polls say 51% of Republicans support it. In this most recent one, is 51% support, 39% opposed, the rest undecided. Are we an outlier, or are we seeing this trend with Republicans around the country?
I think we've seen this everywhere, including in both states that have already legalized, but also in states that have not, that there's growing support for legalization really in all segments of society, with maybe only a few holdouts out there. So it's not surprising to me to see this in Wisconsin.
We've seen a trickle of states and then a rush of states approving marijuana legalization recreationally, I think now in 19 states, medicinally, I think another 19 states. What have things been like this year? Are we seeing more of that trend in action?
Yes. So you see sort of a steady trickle of states, especially turning their attention to legalization for recreational purposes or adult use. because we have so many states already, as you mentioned, about 38 states that have legalized for medical use. Really, in most places, the next question is about recreational use. But we're seeing a steady trickle of states, some doing it through state legislatures, but more commonly, it's been done through ballot initiatives. And we'll see several of those probably pop up this fall or in the coming years in other states.
Now, Wisconsin is a state without a binding ballot initiative process, except for a constitutional amendment, which would still have to start in the legislature. What has the situation been in states like Wisconsin with Republican-controlled legislatures without that binding statewide referendum process?
Yeah, it's very different than in other states that do have the referenda process. The referenda obviously is a way to sort of sidestep your state legislature. And almost by their very nature, state legislatures are more conservative than the population at large. They tend to do things a little bit more slowly. And that's the whole purpose behind many of these ballot referenda processes. But in states that don't have that, you see a lot less movement in a lot of different reform areas, but especially marijuana law. Many of the states, those 38 states that I mentioned that have legalized medical use of marijuana, they include some very conservative states like Oklahoma, Utah, just as two examples, Florida and Ohio as well. But those states have ballot initiatives. They have an alternative process for changing the law. And that's why I think it got a hold in those states, but maybe hasn't in other states like Wisconsin and Tennessee that may have similar politics.
Talking to law professor Rob Mikos from Vanderbilt University, looking at marijuana legalization. Again, a Marquette University Law School poll shows a substantial majority support legalization in the state, including a narrow majority of Republicans. You could tell us what you think about the idea at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Bloomer. Mark, hello. Mark, are you there?
I'm here.
Yep, you're on the air. Go for it.
So I work in hospice care, and I go into people's homes, and I visit cute little grandmas and grandpas all the time. And occasionally I look in their magazine rack, and they have those fancy cookies and candies and gummies. I don't know where they get them. I don't ask. It's none of my business. It takes their pain away. And they swear by it. And by golly, if that grandma can eat that little cookie and her pain goes away and she doesn't have to take opioids, why not? I say go for it.
Mark, thanks for that call and sharing your experience there. Rob, obviously those, I guess, are technically smuggled if you see this in Wisconsin. But are we hearing more attitudes like that as if this is an alternative to pain management, an alternative to something like opioids with all the problems that they entail, are you hearing that argument more and more?
Oh, absolutely. And I think Mark's anecdote kind of nicely conveys that it's even easier to sell medical legalization than it is sort of broader legalization for all adults. So even though those numbers you cited before from the latest Marquette poll, the 69% of Wisconsin voters overall favor legalization for adult use, I would hazard that a much even higher percentage than that, maybe 90%, would support for medical use. And in large part, it's because lots of people know a grandparent or another relative, a parent maybe, who was sick and maybe tried the drug and thought that it benefited them, maybe improved their appetite when they were seriously ill, maybe lessened their pain when they're at end of life. And that creates a very powerful story. It's a very powerful selling point for medical legalization in a lot of states. So in most states, they lead with medical legalization in large part because it's an easier sell for reasons like that, and then later broadened to all adult use. But I think that's part of the sales pitch for medical legalization.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Rob, I've talked to you in the past about how states implement marijuana laws. I think in a lot of states, lawmakers might be taking a wait-and-see approach, see how the early adopters have crafted their laws. What are some of the biggest, I guess, lessons learned from the earliest states to go full-on recreational marijuana legalization?
Well, I think one thing is the sky doesn't fall when you do this. I think that's clear. You know, the world hasn't ended in Colorado and California and Nevada and Massachusetts and all the other places, Michigan next door to Wisconsin, Illinois. The sky doesn't fall. And that was a big concern maybe in the early days when Colorado and Washington State were the first to do this back in 2012. But we now have, you know, 10 years of experience from those states that have legalized it for adult use, and more than a quarter century of experience in states that have legalized it for medical use. So I think all the worries that may have been sparked at the outset, all the pessimism that may have been out there has been largely dispelled. So that's one big takeaway from these states. The other takeaway is more an implementation story. And it's really that, you know, this actually turns out to be fairly complicated, how you pull this off. There are lots of choices that states need to make. It's not like flipping on or off a light switch, you know, ending prohibition. There are things like, you know, how are you going to license suppliers? Are you going to let people use this in public, you know, in bars or other establishments like that, lounges and so on? Are you going to protect people from employment sanctions, from being fired on the job if they use marijuana off the job? So it's actually a pretty complicated reform to implement. Those are the sort of questions that states need to work out usually after kind of taking the plunge. But I think the big message is what we know now is the world doesn't get markedly worse if you do this. And there is some upside to it as well.
We're talking to Rob Mikos, Vanderbilt University law professor, looking at changing public opinion surrounding marijuana legalization, steps taken in other states, Wisconsin not among those states legalizing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Is it time to legalize marijuana in Wisconsin? If so, full recreational, medicinal? What are some of the finer points you'd like to see tackled if we did this? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Rob Mikos, Vanderbilt University Law School professor, studying marijuana legalization in addition to other drug laws, with us to talk about a new poll published last week that shows the majority of people in Wisconsin would vote to legalize marijuana, including a narrow majority of Republican voters. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, or you could post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls now. Mary is with us in Eau Claire. Mary, hello.
Hi. Say, there's something I always wonder. I'm for legalization in general, but what I wonder about Wisconsin, and especially those Republicans there, don't they want to make money? Aren't they for the farmers? Didn't we used to be one of the greatest hemp producers when hemp rope was the only thing you could take to see? And have you ever seen what they do with hemp cloth lately?
Gotcha, Mary. Thanks for the call. Rob, actually, hemp production is legal in Wisconsin. There's, you know, you have to be inspected. It has to be a very low THC percentage of production, partly for CBD oil, some for the fiber products she was talking about. She also mentioned, Rob, the financial benefits. Are we seeing, you know, the supporters of legalization talk that up a lot? Are we seeing huge financial benefits for states that have legalized?
Well, you're seeing a couple of different financial benefits. One are the tax revenues that this generates. So in some states like Colorado that have an established industry, they'll charge a tax on the sale of marijuana, mostly for adult use. It's roughly about 25 to 35% of the retail price of the drug. It varies from state to state, but some states, including Colorado, generate more than $1 billion a year in marijuana tax revenues. And that's actually eclipsing in some states the amount of revenue that they generate from taxes on the sale of alcohol. So it is generating some money, and states will invest that in different ways, turn around, put it into the general fund, invest in schools, that sort of thing. The other thing it's done is in some states, it's generated jobs. You know, it's a new industry that you have people involved in cultivation and the processing of the drug and the retail side, of course, in testing, all the back office operations and so on. And I don't know how much credibility to give some of these reports, but there have been some reports that try to sum up the number of jobs that have been generated in this new industry and suggest that it's about 300,000 in those states that have legalized marijuana for medical and or adult use. There are about 300,000 new jobs that exist in these industries or in associated industries.
Thanks for that call, Mary, at 800-642-1234. Tom joins us now from Toma. Tom, what did you want to bring up?
Hey, I'm very familiar with the industry, both here newly and very familiar with Colorado area. Been in it for quite a while. I have seen the way the recent, I don't know what to call it, a piece of legislation to get it passed that the Republicans tried to push through, or not push through, but bring through. And my only concern was about, as we all know, we're rural people here in Wisconsin. It only allows for you to go to, let's say, concentrate versions of sodas and edibles. How does that leave, you know, the average, you know, person that needs it in rural northern Wisconsin, who can't travel that far? They're unable to grow it themselves. So, yeah, I would be very curious and wary on how the future laws are written. Wonder if he has any ideas on how that might be coming into play.
Thanks for the call, Rob. I think Tom referring to some legislation that was in the legislature, didn't get advanced beyond any sort of committees or hearings or anything like that. But Tom worried, Rob, about kind of, I guess, half measures that don't really do much for the marijuana industry.
Yeah, and I think there's a couple things from Tom's comment. You can always look to other states for models of how to pull this off. You know, anything you might envision has probably been tried somewhere before. So, for example, Tom's concerned about people in rural areas maybe not having easy access to marijuana products once the state legalizes the drug for medical or other purposes. One way other states have tried to handle something like that is to say, if you live more than, say, 25 or 50 miles away from a dispensary, then and only then you're allowed to grow your own. So that's one solution some states have come up with to try to expand access in more rural areas that might be far away from the retail dispensaries that you would see in the bigger cities. The other issue we've seen in some states is some states have kind of gone very slowly in legalizing something like medical marijuana. They don't legalize every product that you see in California or Colorado. They might legalize edibles, but not smokable product, or they might only legalize some oils or other concentrates, but not other things. And I think one general trend we've seen from those states is that even when they start small, I think they realize pretty soon that, again, the world doesn't end when you do this, and you see some openness to gradually expanding those bills. So you might start with something that's fairly modest, but 2 or 3 or 4 years down the road, you might see the legislature in a place like Wisconsin loosening some of those restrictions once they figure out that it didn't end the world when they legalized, you know, a very narrow form of marijuana for medical or other purposes.
Thanks for the call, Tom. We're talking to Rob Mikos, Vanderbilt University law professor. We're talking about marijuana legalization, growth and support for it in recent surveys of Wisconsin voters, still illegal here. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Sandra is with us in Friendship. Sandra, hi.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I wanted to bring up that I'm for legalization, but it's very important that we get medical marijuana legalized for cancer patients and so many others.
Sandra, thanks for that call. I want to follow up with another caller right away. I think on this topic, Lisa is with us in Winters. Lisa, hello.
Hello. The reason I'm calling is because I've had four family members go through cancer treatments. One died, he had bone cancer. My brother had five different primary cancers. He moved to Michigan so that he could get medical marijuana. He is cured. My other sister, I used to drive to Michigan to bring back medical marijuana for her. She's fine. And now I have another sister who's got brain cancer and bone cancer. She's not gonna make it. But I literally drive to Michigan once a week to get her edibles because the girl is 100 pounds, or was 100 pounds, and now is 63 pounds.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's the only thing I can do to help her gain weight.
Lisa, I'm so sorry your family's going through all of this. But again, it speaks to both those callers, Rob, speaks to the support for medical marijuana in particular.
Yes, and it also kind of demonstrates that prohibition doesn't necessarily stop people from using this, from getting access to it. So it begs the question, why continue that? Especially vis-a-vis people who are trying to use it for medical reasons. It doesn't seem to stop that particular use. Does make it more difficult, may force some people to leave the state, or may for some people to rely on relatives to smuggle it in and put themselves in legal jeopardy. But it just illustrates that there are a lot of people with similar stories out there that would really support, especially medical legalization. It's such a poignant story.
Thanks for that call, Lisa. Best to your family. Time for one more caller. Mona is with us in Madison. Mona, hello.
Hello, hi. Taking my call. Comment is, I am all in favor of legalizing marijuana for everybody. However, I would really feel a lot more comfortable purchasing it for my own use if it was available from the pharmacist like Sudafed. So it's monitored and it's controlled somehow. There's some kind of quality control with it.
Interesting.
You don't need a prescription, you can just go ask for it. But, you know,
Mona. We don't have too much time left. But, Rob, how have states handled, I guess, quality control of available marijuana where it's legal?
Yeah, every state where it's legal has a thick body of regulations specifying, you know, how the drug is supposed to be processed, how it's supposed to be packaged. They require testing and then labeling of the product. So you know what you're getting, you know what different mix of cannabinoids are in there, how much THC, how much CBD, and so on. And that's very important. And you look at places like Colorado, they'll have 100 pages of regulations designed really to protect the consumer and inform the consumer so that they're not buying this on the black market, so that they know what they're getting, so that what they get is not laced with, you know, something else like fentanyl or maybe has a pesticide in it.
Thanks for that call. And Rob, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Robert Mikos, law professor at Vanderbilt University, focusing on federalism and drug law, including marijuana legalization. Talked to him after another Marquette University Law School poll came out showing support for legalization here in the state. You can keep sharing your thoughts, by the way, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Tomorrow on the morning show, there's a $1 billion black market in timber. Follow that story with the author of the new book, Tree Thieves, tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Sometimes controversy comes up in unexpected places, like on our Food Friday conversation a couple weeks back. I talked to the author of a zucchini cookbook. I brought up the idea of making relish out of zucchini. She said, no, don't do it. I said it's a good way to use up those overgrown zucchini. She says they should be thrown in the compost pile. Okay, we agreed to disagree and moved on. But last night, I put my side of the argument into action. One of the zucchinis in my garden got big unexpectedly fast, so I made a batch of this zucchini relish recipe. You might have heard me talk about it on the show. Zucchini, bell peppers, onion, plus vinegar and stuff. Broke out the food processor. Zucchini, etc. Ended up making almost 3 pints, and it's really good, no matter what cookbook authors say. You can find a link to the recipe I use at WPR.org. Just search for zucchini extravaganza. If you have excess zucchini, you'll be glad you did. This is Central Time.